Hello there, Mike. Thank you. And hello, everyone. And thank you, too, for joining us in another study of Bible Basis Broken Bread, where we're studying the book that I wrote some years ago called The Better Covenant. And we begin by changing the title of the whole series. Two or three sessions ago, I said I wasn't sure whether calling this a study guide was really an accurate description, because we're not just studying the book, but we're adding lots of stuff to it as we go through, things that aren't in the book at all. This has been a constant journey of discovery for me. As I go from one place to another, the links come together and I begin to see just how comprehensive and how fundamental this whole theme of the transition from one old covenant to a new covenant is in our understanding of the Bible. So this is the Better Covenant study number 27, but I'm going to call it now the Better Covenant Revisited. So we're going to use the book as our basis, but unapologetically, we're going to add all kinds of other things to it as we take our journey. So I'm going to call this one The Remnant Returns. And you know, don't you, that you can get access to these messages on Mike Cole's newliferadio.co.uk. And usually you can get them on my own website, BibleBase.com. But that is down at the present time. So if you want them from our sources, you'll need to go to the Facebook group, which is called Friends of Bible Base, and you'll find them there. Or you can go to the podcast on Bible Base Podcasts, and this will be 27, and you can find that too. We're working on our website, and we'll get back to you as soon as we can. And just to keep this whole theme of innovation going, tonight we have two introductions. He's the first one. The library is now open. What do I mean by that? Well, the history of Israel is made more complex as a result of the order of the Bible books. Now, the word Bible comes from a Greek word, biblia, which is plural, and translatable simply as books, or if you put the definite article in front of it, the books. If we remember that the originals were written on scrolls, and that the Bible is a library of books, we can extract the history of Israel throughout the Old Covenant period. In a modern library, books are rarely ordered by the dates they were written, or even by author. Usually the avenues of books are sorted according to category. And that's true of Hey Biblia, the Bible as well, the books. Let's enter the library then. The library is now open. The library of eternal truth. The Holy Scripture is truly a library of holy books. And as you step into the library, you've arrived at the ground floor, which is the Old Covenant or Testament. F.F. Bruce said, and I agree with him wholeheartedly, that really it was a mistake ever to have called it the Old Testament. It is the Old Covenant. So the library is divided into two floors. On the ground floor, we have the books that were written by and for members of the Old or Sinai Covenant. Yes, even Genesis. Genesis was written to introduce its readers to the two parties to the Sinai Covenant, Jehovah and the covenant nation of Israel. It contains many other truths and is valuable for many other reasons, but it is really an introduction to the Old Covenant. We would not be able to make sense of the covenant that came into being in Exodus without the introductions to the cast list found in Genesis. So here's a recommendation for you. I've mentioned F.F. Bruce already. He was a scholar in the middle part of the last century and an academic, very highly regarded in those kind of academic circles. He was a member of the Christian Brethren and occasionally was criticized by the Christian Brethren. But he wrote a book, and it's still in print, called Israel and the Nations. And I like that because the history of the Bible is, in a sense, all about Israel and the nations. But if you remember that the Bible word for nations is goyim, or Gentiles, a subtitle for Bruce's book could well be Israel and the Gentiles. And that is very much what it's about. Israel, the covenant people with God, and their occasional interaction with the Gentiles, who did not have the law and were not his in the same way. So that's what we find on the first floor. We find all the books of the Old Covenant, and pretty much as we have them ourselves. The order is different, and sometimes they join two books together that we have as one, that kind of thing. But this was the Bible of Jesus. When the New Testament speaks of the Scripture, it's actually speaking about the Old Covenant or Old Testament, the first floor, the ground floor on our library. And then we move up to what in the United Kingdom we call the first floor, but you Americans, being much more logical, call the second floor. And that's the New Covenant Testament. The Gospel and the Acts of the Apostles serve the same kind of purpose. They were written by and for members of the New Covenant. We would not be able to make sense of the New Covenant, which is, I'll emphasize it again, a better word than testament, without the introductions to the cast list found there. And again, there are many truths and life lessons throughout the whole. As we explore our library, we discover that each floor has its books ordered by category, not date. I remember hearing a story once of a scholar who went away for a couple of weeks on a conference, I think it was, and when he came back, his wife had kindly reorganized his whole library and put all the books in size order. I'm not sure that he was very pleased. Libraries usually operate on the basis of category. Its books are ordered by category, not by date, not by size, not by color, but by category. And on the ground floor, that's to say in the Old Testament, we find the broad categories of the Sinai Law, followed by history, the section given over to books that have a more poetic style, which is sometimes called the wisdom literature. Then we discover 20 books of the life and work of people called prophets. And to understand the history, we need to read the prophets, but to understand the prophets, we need to read the histories. So what we're trying to do is combine these two together and create a harmony, an integration, so that you can see the way that the original readers of the prophetical books would have understood them before we get to the way that we would now understand them. Here's another recommendation. When you enter the library, that's to say when you begin reading or studying a Bible book, I would recommend strongly that you ask two basic questions. The first question is, what floor am I on? In other words, which covenant is operating? Is this the Old Covenant or the New Covenant? And when you've decided which floor you're operating on, here's your second question, which shelf am I in? In other words, which category am I in? What genre of Bible content am I in? History, prophets, poetic, apocalyptic? It's a wonderful, wonderful library of books. Let's go on to introduction number two, part two. It was back in study 25 that we began the theme of the remnant. And I've spent more time than usual on the topic as I sometimes feel that the intersection of Israel's history and the ministry of the prophets relative to the New Covenant is not well understood. It's all, this won't surprise you, it's all about context, context, context. The historical context of the prophetic ministries of the Old Covenant record really lights up the long-term significance of the words of those prophets. Remember, when all this started, Israel, the nation that had been brought out of Egypt and became God's covenant people, and were taken ultimately into their promised land, it passed through a time of the judges when the Spirit of God would come upon people to guide and lead the people, and then it moved into a time of monarchy under the house of David. First there was the household of Saul, but then we move on to the house of David. Ultimately, David's grandson, in an act of just pride and arrogance, caused the breakup, the separation. That was the way it would look to secular historians, but actually we know that God was in this. So what's the history so far of Israel, that's to say the northern nation state? Well, a tiny trickle of Jehovah worshippers had trickled south from the northern kingdom of Israel into the southern nation state of Judah. And their history, this little remnant, this little trickle that came south into Judah, their history became joined to the history of Judah. Ultimately, they would become known as Jews from the word Judah. They were identified, became pretty much inseparable from the tribe of Judah. They represented a remnant of the northern kingdom that God had created as a judgment on the house of David. So that remnant joined the southern nation state of Judah. The northern nation state of Israel ceased to exist, and its peoples ceased to be identifiable as they merged with the conquering empires. The northern nation state of Israel never returned from exile. Its existence as people and as a nation state had ended. The prophet Amos had written her epitaph, "The virgin of Israel is fallen. She shall no more rise. She is cast down upon her land. There is none to raise her up." That famous date was 722 years before Christ, when the capital city of that area that had become known as Samaria fell to the Assyrian aggression, and its people were taken by and large into captivity, other than that little remnant, that little trickle that had gone down and become merged with Judah, the southern state. In Judah, the southern state, God gave times of respite and renewal during the next 130 years. But finally, God's strange works, as it's called, of judgment, brought the nation state and the kingdom of Judah to an end, and her people were taken captive, as the prophets had warned. And then you had this tragic epitaph for the southern kingdom of Judah in the last verses of 2 Chronicles. That's 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verses 21. This is a poignant final PS added to centuries of God's care and love for them and the people who actually turned their back upon him. 2 Chronicles then, chapter 36, verses 17 to 21. "Therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldeans, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion upon young men, or virgin, old men, or hoary-headed." Remember, this is Judah we're talking about now. "He gave them all into his hand. And all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of Jehovah, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these were brought to Babylon. And they burned the house of God, and broke down the wall of Jerusalem, and burned all the palaces thereof with fire, and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths As long as it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. For about 490 years, the people of God, God's people, had lived in the land as their inheritance, and so far as we know, as far as the records show, they never kept a single one of those 70-year jubilees properly. And here it says God took them captive to fulfill the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah, until that land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. For as long as it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. So the land had its Sabbaths, but it had them all together in a 70-year exile. Then there's a promise to the exiles. So a remnant of Israel, mingled with the people of Judah, were taken captive, and 70 years later, exactly on schedule, a remnant of those exiles in Babylon returned to the territory of Judah and began to recolonize their ancient homeland. During the exile, they were encouraged with the prophecies that had promised a triumphant return. Unlike the escape from Egypt, the escape from Babylon was going to be one glorious step after another. This time they would not journey through a hostile wilderness, but through a garden paradise until they reached the promised land. Before the exile, the prophets had painted their return in glowing colours. Listen to Isaiah 35, verses 1 to 10. This is a wonderful passage of Scripture. Isaiah 35, "The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given unto it, the excellency of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of Jehovah, the excellency of our God. Strengthen ye the weak hands, and confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert, and the glowing sand shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the habitations of jackals where they lay shall be grass with reeds and rushes, and a highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for the redeemed. The wayfaring men, yea, even though fools, shall not err therein. No lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast go up thereon. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of Jehovah shall return and come with singing unto Zion, and everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy and sorrow, and sighing shall flee away." It is a beautiful passage of Scripture. And when it was originally given, it was spoken with the exiles in view. It was spoken before the exile, but it was spoken to encourage the exiles once they were in exile. These amazing things it says here. It's a highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for the redeemed. The wayfaring men, yea, though fools, shall not err therein. No lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast go up thereon. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of Jehovah shall return and come with singing unto Zion, and everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. And round about the same time, Micah, the other best-known prophet in the southern kingdom of Judah, had written, or someone had written this for him, "I will surely assemble, O Jacob, all of thee. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together as the sheep of Bozrah, as a flock in the midst of their pasture. They shall make great noise by reason of the multitude of men. The breaker has gone up before them. They have broken forth and passed on to the gate and are gone out thereat, and their king has passed on before them, and Jehovah at the head of them." Can you see, this is the description of a great, wonderful kind of victorious pageant of people leaving the exile in places like Babylon with the king before them and Jehovah at the head of them, and they're marching towards the Holy Land and marching to Zion, as the old hymn said, pictured from this particular passage of Scripture. It seemed as though this return from exile of this remnant was going to be a grand production, a spectacle that would put the first Exodus into the shade. And a remnant did return. In fact, other than the trickle that had joined the house of Judah before the exile returned, this was just a trickle. What happened was wonderful in its way, but it hardly lives up to the expectations that would have been born in the hearts of a captive people by those amazing passages of Isaiah and Micah. How are we to understand these prophecies? Some look to a future return of the vanished tribes of the house of Israel. As I write these words, we are 2,500 years farther down our timeline, and extracting the house of Israel from the nations of the world is going to pose some unique problems. A remnant had returned, a remnant of the remnants of the house of Israel, and the remnants of the house of Judah did return. It was a miracle of synchronization, and the superpowers tumbled, and an almost unknown man, a tribal leader named Cyrus, took center stage. Somewhere around 535 BC, an upstart nobody toppled the mighty empire of Babylon, and his name was Cyrus, and he had been predicted by Isaiah 180 years earlier. Listen to this. This is Isaiah 41 and verse 2. I was listening to someone just the other day. You know how often in films and that they'll have one of these things that they call a flashback. And this person who was speaking referred to Isaiah here as having not flashbacks, but flash forwards. He's very much in the midst of a people who he is speaking to, who he has said are going to go into captivity. And he has these flash forwards when God reveals things to him, and it's almost as though in his spirit he's transported into that future time, 180 years ahead of the moment that he stood there giving these words. And he speaks directly to that generation. He himself had long passed by that time. Listen how he speaks about this coming nobody, 180 years before he was on the scene. This is Isaiah 41 and verse 2. "Who hath girded up one from the east, whom he calls in righteousness to his foot? He gave nations before him, and makes him rule over kings. He gives them as the dust to his sword, as the driven stubble to his bow." He's predicting a conqueror who will come with speed and amazing military skills, and it's Cyrus. And in Isaiah 44 and verse 28, he says this. He's talking about the way that only God can know the end from the beginning. Only God is able to speak to the future as though it were the present. And he says this, he's speaking of Jehovah, and he says, who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. Wow. Cyrus, this Gentile, this man from another culture entirely, is going to be God's shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. At this time, the old temple built by Solomon was still standing. But Isaiah is seeing way past that to a flash forward. And he's seen the destruction of the temple. And now beyond it, he speaks of this one named Cyrus, who will say of the temple of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple thy foundations shall be laid. And then in Isaiah 45 and verse 1, it says this, thus saith Jehovah to his anointed, to Cyrus. Now this is a remarkable verse. This word, his anointed, is the Christ. Thus saith Jehovah to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open the doors before him, and the gates shall not be shut. Amazing prophecy. A historian once wrote eloquently of Cyrus, and he said, the tapestry of history has no point at which you can cut it and leave the design intelligible. Yet, the sudden rise to empire around 500 BC of Cyrus, the prince of a petty Persian tribe, is almost such a point. Herodotus, he's the Greek historian, saw the event as the turning point of all Greek history. And kingdoms tumbled one after another under Cyrus's conquering army. And in the first year of his reign, he began a policy of returning exiled peoples to their original homelands. His royal decree targeted specifically the exiles of Judah, and the book of Ezra actually includes a copy of his decree from the royal archives. Here it is, Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath Jehovah, the God of heaven, given me, and he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whosoever that is among you of all his people, his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of Jehovah, the God of Israel. He is God, which is in Jerusalem. And that's the last two verses of 2 Chronicles and the first three verses of Ezra. The exact thing is repeated, so it puts a date stamp on the end of Chronicles and puts a date stamp right in those first three verses of Ezra. And that wasn't the end of it. Not only did he return the people, but Cyrus returned much of the looted temple treasures to the exiles, although some key pieces like the Ark of the Covenant were never retrieved. Less than 50,000 people returned under the governorship of the Prince of Judah, whose name is Zerubbabel, or to give him his Persian name, yes, I've forgotten it. I'll put it in. Part of this group is described as the whole congregation, the whole assembly. That Greek translation of the Bible, the Septuagint, used the word ecclesia here. This was the recovered church of Jehovah. Remember that the old covenant people were intended to be the Church of Jehovah. And now they're back, only a remnant, but they're back in their land. The new immigrants struggled to maintain their life and culture, but they made the establishing of worship a priority and laid the foundations of a new temple. Although people's feelings were somewhat mixed, we find this record in Ezra chapter 3, verses 10 to 13. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of Jehovah, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise Jehovah, according to the order of David, king of Israel. And they sang to one another in praising and giving thanks unto Jehovah, saying, For he is good. There's an interesting little division of hymnology there, if you like. Praising and giving thanks. And they sang to one another. In our hymns, we're encouraged in the New Testament to sing to one another. They sang to one another in praising and giving thanks unto Jehovah, Jehovah saying, For he is good, for his loving kindness, that's his covenant faithfulness. His covenant faithfulness endures forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout, and they praised Jehovah because the foundation of the house of Jehovah was laid. Wonderful. But many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' houses, the old men that had seen the first house, when the foundations of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice. And many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. Part of the reason for the sorrow of the older generation was that they remembered the glories of Solomon's temple. And these foundations of the second temple were on a much more modest scale. The project faltered and was hindered from within and without. And God's prophets, Haggai and Zerubbabel and Zechariah, brought a message of encouragement. This is Haggai chapter 2, verses 1 to 9. It's interesting, you, Haggai date stamps his prophecies very carefully. In the seventh month, in the 21st day of the month, came the word of Jehovah by Haggai the prophet, saying, Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah. Can you see? Zerubbabel is actually in the line of David. He is in the line of David's kings, but he wasn't the king. He was the governor. He was there as Cyrus's men. Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and to the remnant of the people. 50,000 people is now the remnant of the people. Saying, Who was left among you that saw this house in its former glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes as nothing? There is addressing those weeping older men who could only compare these new beginnings with the glories of Solomon's temple, and they wept. And this is the word of Haggai to Zerubbabel. Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith Jehovah, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith Jehovah, and work, for I am with you, saith Jehovah of hosts, according to the word that I covenanted with you. There's that word covenant again. According to the word that I covenanted with you, when ye came out of Egypt, and my spirit abode among you, fear ye not. For thus saith Jehovah of hosts, Yet once, it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the precious things of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, says Jehovah of hosts. This is the house that the ones who remember the old house are weeping over. I will fill this house with glory, says Jehovah of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith Jehovah of hosts. The latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, saith Jehovah of hosts. And in this place will I give peace, saith Jehovah. So that sounds like an amazing promise. What a future this smaller temple seems to have. The latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, saith Jehovah of hosts, and in this place I will give peace. But the erection of that smaller temple was not the harbinger of peace for the people. Down through the centuries they fought battles and lost their land and were conquered and overcome. We'll save all that until our next session. If you're listening or watching this particular study, or close to the time when it was done, please note that we've had a problem with our internet host and our website is down. So please access the audio from our podcast or the Friends of Bible Base Facebook group, and we will restore normal service as soon as possible. So thank you for being with us tonight and looking at this remnant that really seems to compare so poorly with the amazing promises that God gave of a great triumphant march of people with a king, a Davidic king at their head, and Jehovah at the head of that, moving forward, nothing standing before them, all sorrow and sighing, fleeing away, and then these promises coming through from Haggai. I'll shake all the nations, and the precious thing of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, says Jehovah of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith Jehovah of hosts. The latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, saith Jehovah of hosts. And in this place will I give peace, saith Jehovah of hosts. What is to become of those stunning prophecies? We'll begin to make a start of that the next time. All right, so looking forward to having your company. Same time, same place, next week. And until then, God bless you.